Madam Chairman, fellow members, I'm not really a prophet, but for this second century of our existence, we have to be prepared for all sorts of things to happen, which perhaps we have not anticipated, but we should really be trying to think about them. This convention is concerned with change, and surely there has been such enormous changes in the world since our society was founded 100 years ago that it behoves us to look into our structure and our work, our attitudes, our commitment to try and see just where we stand today. To me, it seems rather clear as a traveller around this theosophical world, which from one point of view I know fairly well, I think, we still have a great tendency to carry on as people used to do. We still hear the statement made, we have always done it that way. Now, I feel that we have always done it that way is something we have to leave behind in the first century and not take into the second century. The second century, we have to find a new way. And I feel I cannot underline this sufficiently strongly because of this tendency to rely on the past. And although I myself quote frequently enough from some of our leaders in the past, it isn't simply from the point of view of using them as a big stick. You either do this or else. I don't mean it in that sense at all, but rather, what can we in fact learn from them for the work we have to do today? But sometimes in discussion groups, Dr. Besson, for instance, may be used as a big stick. Some younger people are there. They're producing some new ideas. They want to do something in a different way. And some old and splendid member, of course, probably someone who's paid their dues for 30 or 40 years, and we can be extremely, we can be extremely grateful to them for carrying the society on through difficulties and all that kind of thing. That person will say, what Dr. Besson said, you know? And we'll make some kind of a statement that Dr. Besson is supposed to have said, or perhaps did say. But remember, she said it in the context of 1925, perhaps, you see. And that puts an end to all the argument, all the discussion. Finish. You see, nothing more to be said. Well, I don't feel that that's the sort of way we can move into our second century. Dr. Besant, after all, I never knew her, to my regret, but she seems to have been a most magnificent person in the sense that she had a finger in so many different pies. She was really very, very much concerned with what was going on in the world. She was in the forefront, as it were, of thinking of what was happening and active in those fields. You can't imagine her saying in the context of today the same things as she said 50 years ago. I'm not talking about principles or philosophical fundamentals, but in terms of how we deal with the situation. And the situation today is absolutely different. Well, change for the sake of change may not be always wise, and we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But we have, nevertheless, to really look, I think, very clearly at ourselves and our work to see if we actually fit the world of tomorrow that we're moving into. At Adyar, this last winter, the northern winter, perhaps, we formed a committee in the General Council really to look into some of the actual structural side of our society, to see if people around the world feel that it is adequate to meet the changed conditions of the world we're in now. For instance, to take a question like lodges or study centres. Now, there's much to be said in some countries for study centres. Why? Because basically the people who come into our society really want to study theosophy. They don't want to find themselves suddenly involved in a small lodge. We're all so keen, you know, to start another lodge somewhere, And I very much agree with this in a way. But they suddenly find themselves made into a treasurer or something. And then they have to go around, quite against their will, nudging people, trying to get money out of them. And they say, oh, I don't want to do this, I want to study theosophy. And very often they go away again. So there's much to be said for having study groups with perhaps one member who's a contact with the centre, and the rest of the people studying. And if in time to come they want to form a more permanent group, all right. If they don't, all right. Our job is to make theosophy available, not merely to get members. Although naturally any organisation is that, has subscriptions, as I've already mentioned. So there's much to be said for this idea. And in the context of today, in many parts of the world, the Western world especially, well, unfortunately, it's beginning to be true in some of the eastern part of the world as well now, we have real danger for people going out at night. It's made a big difference to our audiences in many places, especially, I would think, in the United States, where, unfortunately, in quite a number of large cities, people often are attacked, not only in the city itself, but on their way home. They have to get out of a bus if they don't have cars of their own, and have to walk 100 yards to their home, they can easily be attacked. And this has reduced the audiences in many places. But people just won't go into the city, at night. I was recently, a few months ago, in Cleveland, Ohio. And there they have a very beautiful room. They've got an old ballroom from some hotel. It's a beautiful room, marvelous place. But they can't get people to go there at night. So they have Sunday afternoon meetings, and they've decided that what they must do is concentrate on the suburbs. And so they have started, for the time being, 4 study groups in different parts of the city around the suburb area of Cleveland. And the members are working very hard at this. Not only the larger officers, but other members are taking part in starting meditation groups 1 or 2 evenings a week and that kind of thing in these different suburban areas. And in this way, they are getting quite a number of people who wouldn't dream of coming into the city at night. Now this is, as I say, not only just in Cleveland. This is a situation which is existing in many big cities all around the world today. And therefore we have to open our eyes, perhaps, to launching out into a different field of work from one that we have been doing, if our real aim is to make theosophy available, which I believe it to be. So I think it is very necessary for us to rethink a lot of our attitudes and a lot of our activities in relation to the changing world. Now, it is a changing world. And of course, around the theosophical planet, many people are wondering about 1975, what's going to happen. You know that Madame Blavatsky herself mentions that at the end of every century a special effort is made by the hierarchy to try and introduce some new ideas into the field of human knowledge which may help men to progress a little from ignorance towards wisdom. And this same statement is made on a number of occasions also by that elder brother whom we referred to as K.H. Now, in the society, we never make dogmas, or we shouldn't ever make dogmas about anything, and especially not, perhaps, about the existence of those elder brothers. Members are perfectly free, and if we don't maintain the freedom of our members, we can no longer be universal. So, of course, maintaining freedom is immensely important to us, and especially, perhaps, with regard to this, because with the backgrounds that a lot of us have in the Western world, it is not so easy, maybe, to immediately accept the idea of these exalted personages whom we refer to sometimes as adepts and masters. But I think that every member, every new member especially, should acquaint themselves with how our society started, because it did have a rather curious beginning and an interesting history. And I think that in any movement or any organization one joins, one should have enough interest to try and find out something about it. And if you do read the early history of our society, you can't help but being struck by the fact that Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Alcott and a few others were in constant touch with those whom we have now come to call the masters and whom they referred to as the brothers. Men of great wisdom, far more than most of us have, and at any rate you can read about it, I don't have to explain it all here, you know what I'm talking about. And they had an immense influence on the founding of our society, and are sometimes referred to as the real founders, with a capital R. They also mention that at the end of every century, special efforts are made. And it is assumed in the Theosophical world that in the last century, the founding of the Theosophical Society was part of the effort of that century. What is to happen in this century? And members around the world say, are we going to be part of it again? Well, I don't know. What is the obvious answer to that? The obvious answer is it depends on us. I mean, if we could put ourselves, and perhaps it's a little bit, as I said, doubtful to try and do so, in the positions of the elder brothers trying to introduce some new idea into the world, what would we do? We would look around, I suppose, for the organization or the people, persons, who would be most useful, who we consider the most useful for doing this work. If they look around the world and look at the Theosophical Society and find it's a bit stodgy, they'll say, we'll have to find someone else. Wouldn't you do that? Wouldn't I do that? I suppose so. It is true that they have said that ingratitude is not one of their vices. But even so, the world is more important than the Theosophical Society. And if they want to help the world, they have to find the best means of doing so, I imagine. So that if we don't live true to our dharma, so to speak, if we haven't deserted the cause in any way by chasing after all kinds of false gods or running down dead-end streets, I don't suppose we can doubt that we shall be part of the new movement. But if we have deserted the cause, and if we have run down all these dead-end streets, why should we be? Doesn't seem to be any point. Doesn't seem to be even debatable. And so it comes down to ourselves. If we're going to be part of the new effort, it's because we deserve it, individually and as a society, and not anything else but that. When we look back in those days, we can see that the whole thing started much earlier than 1875. HBB was traveling around the world and directed to do so, involving herself in all sorts of interesting fields of research, mostly in the religious and philosophical side of things. And all this was preparatory work to the founding of the society. Probably, we would be not wrong if we think that a lot of preparatory work has been going on now again. Just exactly what that is, I'm not in a position to say. But I believe that if we had our eyes open, and today, with the enormous advance in the scientific world, the mass media, which puts everything at our disposal immediately, we might be able, perhaps, to see trends that are happening in the world around us, which might be something to do with the future movement, the future effort. I personally would think that that rather interesting and curious group of young people you will find around the world everywhere might have something to do with this. I'm not trying to force any idea upon you. I'm only thinking aloud for myself. Of course, there are young people around the world who don't fit into this category. Thousands and thousands of them. There are the very vicious ones who will perhaps do someone to death just for kicks. But I'm not talking about that type. I'm talking about the rather different type whom you meet in every country. You don't hear much about them in some countries. and in others, very often you hear to their detriment, because some of the extremists are pilloried, as it were, in the press belonging, as it does, to the establishment. And so naturally, they are a little nervous of this upsurge of new ideas, which you find amongst many young people. I find them a very interesting type, and they seem to me to be much the same all around the world. I think if I had C.W. Leadbeater here to ask, I would ask him, in reference to his the information he has put before us regarding the transfer of souls from the moon chain to the earth chain, whether a new boatload, as he called them, whether a new boatload had arrived recently. Because it seems to me that perhaps that is just what has happened. Because so many of these young people, in my experience at any rate, are different in some way from my generation. And it's not just a matter of the changes in the conditions of the world, the circumstances, and so on. There seems to be something very fundamental in character, a willingness to suffer for one's ideals. I even know young people who've been to prison rather than break with their acknowledged idealism. A great interest in the world, a true interest wherever there is a in anything which savors of unbrotherly attitudes, whether nationally or interracially or even socially. They have a very much truer acceptance of individuals as they are, irrespective of background and anything else. Accepting people just as they are, no matter what nation they belong to, no matter what religion they belong to, no matter their color of skin. I find this very interesting. Dr. Besant and C.W. Weil wrote frequently about the beginnings of the sixth sub-race. But because, I suppose, because many of us reading those books which deal with this have read about the beginnings, supposed beginnings, I don't know for myself, of some sixth root race in some distant time, centuries ahead of us, I believe that most of us are conditioned by that into thinking that all this is going to happen. I suppose that really it's happening. We've always been saying, everybody, one day the sixth sub-race has got to start. We're going to have new people coming into the world, and they're going to think differently. They're going to do this, and they're going to do that. We've been talking about it for years and years and years. But isn't that exactly what's happening? I'm not talking about all, but aren't we already seeing now around us an immense number of the new people who do think differently? And they've come to stay. Do let's remember that. They have come to stay. They're not suddenly going to disappear. They've come to do a job. Their job is to bring into human life a new way of looking at things, which basically, I suppose we may say, speaking theosophically, is based on the buddhi approach, although heaven knows they may not necessarily have reached that. Dr. Besant is quoted as saying that when this new group of people come into the world, there will be a tremendous accent on sex. And so there is. Sex, as she went on to explain, being, as it were, the basic field of union. But that as time goes on, the emphasis will rise through the various levels of consciousness until sometime later, it may be quite a way ahead, the consciousness is really centered in union at a buddhic level and not at anything less than that. Well, we have perhaps a long way to go. But this is just what we're seeing. These are the people who've come to do a job. And if they're going to do the job, they can't compromise all the time. with the situation, so they have to stick out against it and do all kinds of things which we older people criticize. We can't perhaps do anything else. We're conditioned to. But I think in the theosophical world, we ought to try to be able to broaden our view of what may be happening around us. The astrologers tell us we're moving or have moved into Aquarius from Pisces. I'm not an astrologer and I don't know much about it. But I think that in the normal precession of the equinoxes, according to the astronomers, we are apparently moving into a new sign. This sign is said to be one which is free and universal, just as the sign of Pisces was somewhat constricted. Water tends to find its own level. Air is utterly and completely free by comparison. So if we're moving, if this be true, and I'm not an astrologer, but if it be true, so we're moving from that to this other thing, it seems to me to be exactly what is happening, in fact. We are moving into a world in which universals are becoming much more important, not only amongst the young, but amongst the old too. Moving into an age where you can talk about a world something, with the beginning of the United Nations idea. When our society was founded 100 years ago, no one could possibly think in terms of a world something. No one did. Everyone was completely divided up into their nations and their religions and their races and so on. The idea of a world brotherhood must have been madness, I would have thought, to those people in the last century. Today, it's an easy idea to us, although we don't necessarily begin to practice it. So I feel, as we look into the future, it may be that we're getting a hint of the beginnings, not the ultimate, the beginnings, in this new attitude which we are finding around us, especially in the young people of our world. Now, as I say, I put this forward purely as an idea and not with any intent to force it upon anyone else. I was looking at ADR in a dictionary regarding the word nucleus, and I found a number of statements about it. It is referred to as a kernel, as of a nut. We have plenty of nuts, haven't we? A central mass about which matter is collected. The central succulent part of an ovule, I don't know what that is exactly, in which a plant is generated. The germ of a cell. It also has some astronomical association. Then in another dictionary, positively charged central portion constituting the main mass of an atom, the central part or thing round which others are collected, the kernel of an aggregate or mass, a beginning meant to receive additions, central part of a plant cell, an animal cell. Quite interesting when we regard this word that Gros was talking about. We all say we're going to form a nucleus. And a nucleus seems to have various jobs to do. Not only is it, as it were, the central active part in a cell for which something is supposed to happen, but it is also, according to these definitions, something around which other things are supposed to collect themselves. And I feel that that probably applies to our use of the word. The nucleus is very dynamic, isn't it? Am I right in saying, no biologist as I am, that a cell that didn't have a nucleus, or where the nucleus, so to speak, shriveled up and died, that cell would cease to be very much use? You might say the cell would pass out, so to speak, would die, wither away. So the nucleus is of extremely great importance to the
the cell in which it is working. So that if the lodge of a city is to be a nucleus for that city, it has to be an extremely active thing in the city. If for some reason or other one of our lodges should wither away through becoming so old-fashioned that it didn't cut any ice anymore, then the whole effect of theosophy in that city would be spoiled. I mean, we wouldn't be channeling life. The nucleus is a dynamic center within the cell. And then if that light is shining, to change the picture, if that light is shining, then it will attract the moths. With all due respect to the members. Perhaps I should say the butterflies. You see what I mean? The nucleus is essentially a tremendously active thing. And I think each one of us has got to be that in ourselves. Each lodge for the city, the section for a country, the society itself for the world. This and nothing less than that flows inevitably from our use of the word nucleus. I think that we have got to, therefore, look into our work and see what we're doing. I want to quote to you from Dr. Besant, but again, not simply because it's Dr. Besant, but because what I think she says is of great significance even today. Well, Dr. Besant said this: one great danger, as HPB recognized, is a danger of getting into a groove and so becoming fossilized in the forms of belief that many of us hold. This will involve posterity in the same troubles which so many of us have experienced with regard to the teachings amongst which we were born. You see, most of us came from a Christian background, and we probably had more or less of a struggle to get out of that background into something which we call theosophy and feel to be bigger and so on and so on. Each of us will have our own view about that. So it's immensely important that within our own movement we don't do the same thing all over again and create a kind of dogmatic pattern within the Theosophical Society, which other people have got to come in and break up again, which is probably what might easily happen, because we're already getting into dogmatic patterns by carrying on, you see, in 1975 in the same way as we did in 1925, instead of really looking at the thing again. So it isn't surprising, really, in many of the lodges when young people come in that they want to smash it up. But they say, this doesn't work anymore. This belongs to the past. It isn't doing the job of 1975. It isn't in touch with the world of today. And the old people resist and fight like that and say, ooh, not attack our Theosophical Society. We've always done it this way. Well, I'm not saying that the older people are necessarily wrong. The old people, as I said before, are very devoted and are doing their best, I'm sure. But there's a tendency as one gets older to get a little bit, you know, sort of set in one pattern. One can't help it. It's something to do with getting old. But in our movement, it's a very dangerous thing. And I feel that every one of us ought to be able to look at this without, how should I say, without trying to defend it somehow. I don't know whether you understand what I mean. We're always told to be objective, to really have no personal investment in these things. But it's terribly difficult not to have a personal investment. It's very, very difficult when we've sought security and found it in a certain place to then have that place attacked, as it were, so that we have to look at it again. We don't want to do that. We feel comfortable. But I think that as a theosophist, this is really what is demanded of us. It may be a lot to ask of anybody, but we need to have this openness of approach to the new ideas which may come our way, and not, as Dr. Besson says, become fossilized. This is a tendency to become fossilized. Charles Brizy, who was the general secretary in Belgium for some years, she's dead now, she gave a lecture which I always remember, so beautifully entitled, Theosophy, No, not theosophy. The Theosophical Society, museum or laboratory. Well, I don't remember exactly what her conclusions were, but the point is clear, isn't it? That she felt the danger was that we should just become a museum instead of a laboratory in which fresh work is going on all the time, actively into the future in the context of today. If I may digress for a moment about Serge Brizzi. She had an extraordinary experience in the war. I don't know whether you've ever heard of it, but I can't help telling you, because sometimes I like to feel, as an old and conditioned theosophist, that something or other looks after its own. You'll see what the story is. At any rate, Serge Brizzi, cut off, of course, through the German invasion and occupation of Belgium, was working in the underground. And she was a person who you perhaps, who didn't look very closely, you perhaps think that she was a quite, I don't know what word to use, it sounds insulting, to say ordinary looking person, you know. I mean, she wasn't very tall, she wasn't very special in any way, she was just a small, nice person, and you wouldn't necessarily notice her very much. And one day she was traveling in a tram car with a little bag of very incriminating documents and information. And the tram car was stopped, and everybody in it was ordered out by a German officer and a couple of soldiers. And they were all lined up in the street to be searched. And she thought her last hour had come, you see. One from last, anyway. And she didn't know what to do. She was standing there with her bag and so on. And I don't know what prompted her, but this is why I say something must have been looking after her. When the soldiers came to her, two soldiers with frisking people, you see, and the officer was standing a little bit behind, she held out her case to the officer and said, "Would you mind holding this for me? Because it's very wet underfoot, I don't want to put it down." And she held up her arms to be searched. And after she had been searched, the German officer had So perhaps there is a power that looks after some of us occasionally. Oh, that was a pure digression, but I find it an interesting and true story. I go on with Dr. Besant's quotation. "The society is, and always has been, intended to be a living body and not a fossil. And a living body grows and develops, adapting itself to new conditions. And if it is to be a body which is spiritually alive, it should be gaining continually a deeper and fuller view of truth. It is absurd for us to pretend, at our present stage of evolution, that we have arrived at the limits of knowledge it is possible for man to obtain. All of us are aware that our conceptions of truth are continually deepening. Nothing could be more fatal to a society like ours than to hallmark as true special forms of belief and then look askance at anyone challenging them and our trying to impose them on those who come after us. If the society is to live far into the future, we must be prepared now to recognize, quite freely and frankly, that our knowledge is fragmentary and that it is partial, that it is liable to very great modifications as we learn and understand better." It isn't absolutely clear whether she's talking about our comprehension of theosophy entirely or whether she's also looking at the way we try to make it available. It seems to me it applies in both ways. Now, in the United States, where I was last year, they have four properties in very beautiful places. These are camps which are open in the summer for a number of months, dependent upon how long the snow permits that. In most cases, the snow lies and they can't open the camp very early in the spring. One of these camps is about 7,000 feet up in the high Sierras of California. One of them is on an island right off the border of Canada and the United States on the far northwest part of the country. One is in New York State, again up in the hills, and another is in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas in the central south. And these camps are open for many months during the summer and have constant programs and constant streams of visitors. The thing that prevails is, of course, informality. People can come with their families, they can come with a caravan, as it were, to camp, come in tents, there are little huts available for certain people and so on. People can build their own if they wish. And there's usually a central dining room where people can get their food. And meetings are held either indoors or outdoors, mostly out of doors in the summer, lying on the hay or whatever it may be. And all sorts of people get their introduction to theosophy in those circumstances, because it's not reserved for members only. And so a lot of people come, a lot of young people come, and so on. And during these camps, which I visited last year, I thought to myself that I would ask a certain number of questions. I think if I had perhaps thought it out better, or rather with more experience, you'll understand what I mean, I would have asked a few questions differently and possibly asked some that I didn't ask and so on. But I kept to the same questions at each camp, and because I wanted to find out what the members were thinking about, well, about tomorrow and how we should be doing things. What other things we should be doing if we're not doing, so on. Well, I chose six main subjects. One was what I've been talking about, the immediate future. One was our organization. One was publicity. One was publications and books. One was our own life and the need for change in our own pattern of living. And one was what is called, rightly or wrongly, the generation gap. And it started off each day with perhaps 5 or 10 minutes introduction of the subject, and then wrote out these questions, which were given to groups, the number of people attending divided up into groups according to how many there were, and each person took a question, each group took a question, and they dealt with that for about an hour. The good thing about it was that in a small group everybody participates. If you have a big group discussion with about 30 people, about 20 of them never say anything. So it's very good to break up into small groups for that purpose. And then we all came back into the main group and discussed the findings, one after the other, of these different groups. And we were never in time for lunch any day. The bell rang always before we were finished. And we had really rather a good time on this. I don't know whether I could recommend to your General Secretary that there might be some discussion of some of these points in the Australian section also, because I've got somebody at Olcott now tabulating all the results from the four different camps, putting them into a sort of into a form which is a little bit more readable. Otherwise, we just have notes. And I thought I might read you some of these questions, because you might agree with the thinking that goes into this question, which I suppose has something to do with me. and my feeling that there are so many things that we have to look into, not just to waste time, but really seriously to consider as we go on into the new century. So I'll read you the questions without much comment. Under what do we expect in 1975? What does the new cycle mean to you? Is it a complete break with the past? Some people thought it was. Some felt that we had to use the expression I've already used, be careful to keep the baby and not throw it out with the water. Our objects, have they been fulfilled or not? In part, should we make additions to them? Are changes needed in this new century? There are a number of people who feel that our first object might, for instance, include the addition of the word art. No, I mean, the second object should have art in it as well as philosophy and religion and science. And some people think with regard to the first object, it should be extended to cover all the kingdoms of nature and not only man. What do we know? Underlining the word know. What do you and I actually know? And what does this knowledge really mean to us? Supposing you say, or you might say, I know that reincarnation is true. Do you? Do you know that reincarnation is a law of nature? Do you believe it? Does it seem reasonable? Does it seem intellectually acceptable? All these things, but what, in fact, does one know, really? And if one knew, wouldn't one act differently? Then again, I'm not trying to push a pin into any particular person, but I feel that if we really knew that everything we do is preparing for our next life, we can't do anything about the past ones, but if we really knew that everything we do is preparing for the next life, and things will happen on the basis of how we're living now, we might live differently, might we not? But as long as it remains a nice and acceptable theory, perhaps we can't be said to know it deeply enough. So, with regard to this question then, what do we know? What, if anything, can we accept on faith? HBB is very much against us accepting things on faith. What is faith in this context? What do we expect of this century's effort? What will its form be? Will it be a teacher? Will it be a teaching? Will it be a widespread influence? Will a new power be released? What, I wanted to find out, were people thinking? And then theosophy itself. And this is a point I think we really need to get some kind of an agreed opinion on. Is it to be defined as a truth that is infinite? This, of course, was the view of our late president, Brother Sri Ram. He felt that theosophy was synonymous, really, with truth, and therefore that it was something we would never fully grasp or fully understand, that it couldn't be contained in all the books or all the libraries of the world. It would always be beyond. And yet we have also quite a strong group of people within the theosophical movement who feel that theosophy is a special teaching, to some extent limited, as it was presented at the beginning by HBB and through the letters of the masters and so on. And this view is very, very definitely and truly held by lots of members around the world who feel that any other ideas that are put out by other people which seem contradictory to those original teachings cannot be theosophy. It is quite a point. And insofar as people are always urging us to open our doors, to draw nearer to other theosophical groups who have broken away, this becomes an even more important point, because it is on this point largely that they differ at present. We would like at our Congress in New York especially to invite representatives or even members of these other theosophical groups. But if their view is that we may not mention any theosophical idea which has come into our literature since the turn of the century, or should we say since 1891 when HBB died, then it's going to be very difficult. But it is a point, I suggest to you, which requires our thinking. Then on the subject of organization, should the society run its own yoga school? Arguments for and against this, what are the possible dangers? Well, as we know, the world is full of yoga schools. Some of them are all right, some of them are not so good. I remember the time when I joined the society, when the mention, for instance, of Hatha Yoga caused all our members to hold up their hands in horror. Literally. They said, oh, Hatha Yoga, oh, awful. You know? As though it was really work of the devil or something. Now, what a changed condition reigns in the world today, where thousands, millions of people
I'll study Hatha Yoga. But of course, we're dealing here with two extremes, so to speak. I mean, if we can get somewhere back into the middle, we can see that there are, of course, dangers in Hatha Yoga for those who proceed with certain exercises and so on without being properly prepared for them or not living the right kind of life, then they really can be dangerous. But on the other hand, nobody can say that the asanas of Hatha Yoga are in themselves wrong. They are very healthy. And if people choose to do Indian exercises today in the way many of us did Swedish exercises when we were young, all right, there's no harm in that. But it should be guided. Now, we have, for so many years, taken the line in the Theosophical Society, oh, we won't have anything to do with that. And so we've pushed away from ourselves thousands of people, I suppose, who have perhaps fallen into the wrong hands often enough. Now, what are we to do? Are we to continue to do that? Are we to have some school of our own? Or are we to inform ourselves, as we might do, of the yoga groups and teachers in every country who can be regarded as responsible? This is becoming possible because organizations are springing up to vet, as it were, the different teachers to see if they really measure up to what they say. So, should we, for instance, at ADIA, should we have some kind of a yoga school so that people coming to study at ADIA would have the opportunity?
HPB was rather clear on that last point. She even says in one place that she regrets that the rule by which people could be expelled from the society from what she calls backbiting and slandering other members had been removed from the statute book. She evidently thought it was a very good rule, and backbiting and slander are words that she frequently uses with regard to the members, unfortunately. Which is really rather sad. But she felt that anyone who really didn't live up to brotherhood could just jolly well get out. That this society is supposed to be a society of people who behave, not a society of people who don't know how to behave. And so we can ask ourselves this question again. Do we engage in the gossip? Or don't we? Do we try to get away with it? You know how people do, they'll edge up to you and say, well, of course I don't want to spread rumors, but I think you ought to know. That sounds like and you know from the beginning that they're just longing to tell you some terrible story about somebody and they're finding an excuse for themselves. Well, it's probably better not to tell such stories, really. So, should we expel anyone? That's quite an idea. Others will say, oh no, universal brotherhood contains everybody, which is true. Which is true. We can't possibly expel anyone. Well, there's a difference of point of view there. The other day, we had an experience in India. It was in Sri Ram's time, not recently, in which one of the Indian lodges had a very beautiful and valuable building centrally placed in one of the cities, and only a very small membership. And it struck a group of people, who all belonged, I think, to the same family or group, that it would be rather useful to join this lodge, finally to outnumber the old members, and then decide to sell it. And that was their avowed aim. However, it became known. It became known that they wanted all to join the lodge, and then they would have a meeting about selling the building, and they would be in the majority, so they would sell it, and they'd all get some money in their pockets. And that was their only reason for joining the lodge. They had no interest whatever in theosophy, the money-making scheme. Well, those members who had already succeeded in joining were asked to leave. Well, that's what they decided in the Indian section. Maybe that was quite right. So, it is a moot point, you see. The society has a disassociation policy. In how far should the society remain neutral before the problems of today? We are frequently accused of doing nothing. People often say to us, what do you do? We see when we give lectures, we have books. We say, yes, but what do you do? What do we do? It's very difficult, of course, to do anything in that sense, because if we're going to be universal, we've got to have people on both sides of every argument. So we can't stand for one side or the other. We can only stand very generally for our objects. But the trouble is that if you stand against
For instance, you might say that the Theosophical Society ought to take a firm line with regard to the racial situation of South Africa, for instance. What would be the result of that? What could we really do about it? Immediately, of course, you're involved in practical means for dealing with the situation. And as soon as you deal with means, you get differences of opinion. So it's extremely difficult for us to know what to do, except to take a general line. But even so, the General Council, I think, would be well advised to consider very, very carefully any statement made even with regard to that. Because the easiest thing in the world to infringe universality. So, where can we take action with regard to the problems of today as a society? Of course, the Theosophical Order of Service was invented, so to speak, by Dr. Besant in order to get over this problem, so that groups of members could join together with a theosophical name, as it were, in order to take action in any field they wanted to. But it didn't commit the society itself. Many lodges have only meetings open to members and friends. I put that in quotes. Many countries around the world, they only have meetings for members and friends. They never have member meeting alone, and they don't have public lectures alone, so to speak. But they always have just this little business of members and friends. And from the point of view of a lecturer, I find that difficult. I think you're talking to the public, you can talk in one way. If you're talking to members, you can talk in another way. If you're talking to the public, you have to say you. If you're talking to the members, you have to say we. And that makes all the difference in the world, I find. And to members of friends, I don't know what to say. To invent a new pronoun. Well, what is the value of meetings for members only? Can we afford to dispense with them? And what part today do public meetings play in relation to television and all the other things that we have to contend with? Are lodges and branches more effective than study centers? Well, I mentioned that earlier on. Oh my goodness. I'm sure the kettle's on already. On the publicity side, what attracts people to join the society in the first place today? Is it lectures? Is it books? Is it personal contacts? And why do so many leave again so soon? In very many places, the membership that enters is more or less balanced by the membership that leaves. Now, why is that? There must be surely something we're not doing. Or maybe on occasion something we do, of course. If we're all going to be school moms, you know, and tell everybody what they've got to think and do, then of course they'll go away. But it may be something we're not doing. And that again involves us in becoming aware of the world we're in. If to make theosophy available as a society's dharma, which I personally believe it to be, should we not try to establish permanent contacts with and through the mass media? Permanent contact. Radio, film, television, newspapers. What would be the most successful way of presenting our ideas today by these means? The General Secretary, at least the recent General Secretary in Brazil, arranged with the most widely distributed daily newspaper in São Paulo, which goes all over the country, to have a theosophical column. It's only once a week, but nevertheless, every Wednesday or Thursday, whatever it is, there is, in Portuguese, of course, theosophical column, and he produces an article, or someone produces an article for that, every week. Now, I find this really a very excellent idea. I should imagine that tackling the right people in the right way, it might be possible to do it in other places. But it certainly puts the name before people, puts theosophy on the map, so to speak. And this is a thing that I feel is tremendously necessary because, now, for instance, I had four interviews in Adelaide the other day, television interviews. And not one of those four people knew anything about theosophy. I'd never heard of it. I'm not blaming Adelaide, although I might, of course. I might I might pick on the Adelaide Lodge and say, you're not doing your stuff. But as I have a chairman from Adelaide, I won't do that. Because it's all over the world. I was in so many places in the United States, and in South America, and in Europe, and never, never, never do I have an interview with anyone who's ever heard of theosophy. They always start off with a hopeless question. You know, we have 3 minutes, Mr. Coates, what is theosophy? The only person, you may even remember her name, but I don't, was a woman in Brisbane. There's a woman who I was interviewed with in Brisbane about 4 years ago, and she's the only person in my recollection anywhere in the world who had heard about theosophy. Now, that's very bad, you see. All these people are in the international field, so to speak. You know, they're in the world of the mass media. We must somehow get out into this. And if people don't come to lectures, then we've got to make a tremendous effort to get on the television or on the radio, things of this kind. We're on the radio already, but we have to go further. We've got to get on the television. And in some regular way, it's going to cost money, it's going to require effort. But somehow we've got to move into the field where people are going to see us. It's all very well to say, and it is, of course, true in a sense, that, well, if they want theosophy, they'll come to us. It is true in a way, and there are people who do that very thing. But our job is to make it available so they know where to come. Therefore, we have to be there and say, here it is. Take it or leave it. If they respond, they know where to come. If they don't respond, there's nothing much you can do with them anyway. Sorry, I don't mean that rudely, but, you know. Do we need a professional public relations officer, nationally and internationally? Well, I'm beginning to think perhaps we do. Is our way of advertising the best way? Do we ever ask what other ways there are of advertising? How far have we gone into this? I don't know if we have. We've always thought, well, the Lodge Secretary can do that. The Lodge Secretary may be a most delightful person, but may know nothing whatever about public relations, you see. So I'm not at all sure that we shouldn't find people who are trained in this field to help us in this side of our work. For instance, in England, we have for many, many years had an arrangement with the Underground Railways. And we've had big posters put in the Underground Railway stations, as long as I can remember. I don't know, I think we have about 40 places, something like that. And for many, many, many years, we used to put up only the titles of the Sunday lectures for the month with the author, the speaker's names and an address. And that was all we put. And I'm quite sure it brought some people to our lectures. Well, one day we had a publicity officer. Excuse me, someone's glasses are there. They may get broken if you stand on them. We had a publicity secretary who thought of doing something else during the holidays. There weren't any lectures. And instead of leaving the spaces blank, she wrote something like the first one, I think, went, when you're traveling home in the evening after a busy day at the office and you have nowhere to sit down and you're strapped hanging in a crowd of people, do you ever think to yourself, what on earth is life all about? Something like that, you see. And of course it goes very, 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 very much home. It goes home to everybody who's doing just this very thing. And then it went on to suggest that there might be some answers and gave an address. Well, you know, we got far more replies to that kind of advertisement than we ever apparently got to the others. And then we developed the idea of putting searching questions into the Sunday newspapers, in one of the columns, the personal column or something like that. You know? Searching questions about life and asking for answers and, or requests for answers and so on. And we had a lot of mail coming in from that. Now, I'm only mentioning that there are ways of doing things that perhaps haven't struck us as yet. And there are all sorts of ways that a public relations officer could probably help us. Should we have more regional schools of wisdom like they have in Aliar and in Crotona? Should we be concerned with chairs in universities, trying to get chairs? There is a chair in the University of Leiden in Holland. I expect Mrs. van Dissel can give me the exact name of it. I'm not quite sure, but I think it's something to do with a study of Oriental philosophies in the light of theosophy, or something like that. Is that right? Yes. The word theosophy comes into it. It's a study of the Oriental religions and philosophies in the light of theosophy, something like that, which is very good. It's been there for 10 years or 12, 15 years, perhaps, in the University of Leiden. How may we best encourage respect for the society in the public mind? that comes home to most of us, of course. I mean, it comes down to our own behavior in the first place. Do we really behave like normal people? We all like to think so. But do we, you see? I mean, I found my children very useful in this respect, because I've had arguments about this question and said, I feel a perfectly normal person. My children roar with laughter, you see. Daddy, how can you be so stupid? You don't know how peculiar you are. Well, I think the Scottish bard Burns was very right when he said, "Would some poor of the gift of geas, the seer sells as others see us." It's only too true. We don't really know, perhaps, how we look to other people. Now, therefore, the society either gains in respect or loses it through us and our behavior. And we have an immense responsibility, I feel. A thing that often happens to me, at any rate, is that I get attacked from the point of view of HBB having been considered a very peculiar person, and she was a fraud, and she was a sorceress, and she was this, that, and the other. You know? And so often one has to try to defend that position. I think we should do well to try and find out what really happened with regard to HBB so that we can defend it. Then on books and publications. Our membership is often little aware of what is going on in the world around them. How can we have a permanent research group or groups to find out about such information, relating the findings of science, and I was going to say fringe science, to theosophical viewpoints? I could elaborate on that, but I don't have time. There's so much going on in the world now that most of us are not really aware of it. I was very glad to hear mention made of this by your General Secretary last night. Do we need a Stepping Stone to Theosophy kind of magazine that can be sold to the public, less sensational than Fate or Prediction, more discriminating, yet introducing real occultism? Could we maintain such a magazine usefully, internationally? Would it be valuable? Should we have a kind of publication which is geared specifically to the world of youth? Well, all these things were acceded to by the vast majority of the members there in America. They all thought to be very desperately needed another magazine which wasn't as serious, shall I say, as a theosophist, presenting material such as I mentioned, like, for instance, what is happening with the sensitivity of plants. Well, I think I told some members in Melbourne, I think, about an interesting experience, it's really a film, I saw, it's not an experience. But this film covered a lot of experiments being made in the ESP world and was monitored by Mitchell, the astronaut. And I got the film over from America to Adyar. I'd seen it in America. And one of the things it shows there is an experiment with yogurt. And I do find this so extraordinary. I mean, I'm not as much of a scientist. Anyway, they took this yogurt and put it into two little jars, put one here and one there on a table. They assure one that they can do this experiment with the yogurt in the kitchen, far away. But they put it on the table so they could take a photograph of the experiment. And this bit of pot of yogurt is attached to one of these very delicate electroencephalograph type of instruments. And immediately you can see this little needle making a vibratory sort of mark on the paper. I suppose, from whatever life there was in the yogurt, the bacteria or yeast or whatever is in it. I don't know. Well, this other pot has no connection whatever, except they're standing on the same table. They poured milk into this pot. And as soon as the milk was poured into pot A, pot B reacted enormously to the arrival of milk in this pot. The experimenters don't tell us whether they think this pot of yogurt was either pleased or jealous. But at any rate, it reacts very strongly, and as it is an experiment which can be repeated as often as you like, it can be regarded, I suppose, under the heading of scientific experiment. Well, where is the connection? They, of course, don't know what the connection is. Have we anything to say about that? Well, there's this kind of information, I think, which we ought to be putting out around the theosophical world. I have to stop because tea is ready. I'm sorry. There are lots of things to be said about that, which I could share with you some other time, perhaps. Where are we? Yes, I'm talking about this magazine. Is it useful to publish many of our older books in the often outdated originals? May we make changes? Not as polite to the authors. Now, in India, this is considered very important. We mustn't change Dr. Besant's words. Well, we don't know what to do, because there is a book of Dr. Besant's, which is full of very interesting material. But on one occasion, she says, for instance, that if you want to go quickly, you should go on a bicycle. And better still to come, if you want to go really quickly, you have to take a balloon. Well, this is written a long time ago, obviously. But it just doesn't apply today. And and even if you put a footnote to say this was written in 1903 or wherever it was, the effect isn't good. So you could imagine certain people, especially across in the younger generation, pick up a book like that and say, well, really? Go back to the nuts I mentioned earlier. Well, what is the correct procedure? Should we re-edit these books? Should we use footnotes? Are we permitted to make changes in somebody else's book? Should we print only extracts or abridgments? Cut out certain parts and put several books together? What exactly is the right thing to do with this? And we are much concerned with this at ADDIE at the moment, because we have requests for many books. For instance, Mr. Jinarajadasa's First Principles in Theosophy. Now, this was the questions were asked about this to a number of our scientific members around the world. And as a result of their replies, there are only two chapters in that whole book that they agree we could publish without alteration. And in many of them, the science is no longer right. It may have been right when he wrote it, but science has a tendency, after all, to correct itself with further investigation. And the science isn't right. So are we to go on putting out a book in which the science is not right just because it's Mr. Jinarajadasa's? See? What are we to do about it? Well, the first decision was, well, we won't reprint it at all. Well, then there was a clamor from all around the world, where it is used so much as a sort of beginner's study book, for when they want more copies. South America especially, where he was well known. What are we to do? Some of the things in the American section want changed because they refer to the racial situations. For instance, there's a place where Brother Raja writes that these faces, and he portrays the faces, I think, of Australian Aborigines, amongst others, and various other Negroid-type faces, and says these are not, from our standards, very beautiful. Well, I'm told by people in the United States that you can't publish that anymore in the United States. Not only because it is not happy within the racial situation, but it's even illegal, I believe. It's even against the law to publish anything of that sort. So what are we going to do about this? See, it's really a problem, because there's so much in that book which is good. So, see, you have all these problems to look at for the future. Should we not make more efforts in the field of art, visual education, audiovisual, exhibitions, dramas, pictures? Travel and nature could be mediums through which our ideas could be presented. And what about songs? Should we have a theosophical pop song? Well, why not? Why not? There are going to be pop songs anyway, so why couldn't we have a theosophical one? If it's provided it's not kind of vulgar. But you know, there are already pop songs, if I may call them that. Probably it's the old-fashioned, and I was going to say square, but that's not the right word anymore. Straight way of looking at it. I believe straight's now the word in vogue. Well, I'm still old-fashioned, maybe. But I don't know. There are songs about the universal life and brotherhood and so on, stemming from the pens of a number of young composers, which are very beautiful. So there's nothing essentially wrong with that. Then, as far as life goes, I quoted from HBB that a theosophist is one who has abandoned the old and trodden highway of routine. And I ask myself, have I? Have you abandoned the old and trodden highway of routine? Or are you still going on with the same old things? Well, she says, if you're going on with the same old things, you can't be a theosophist. And then we have to enter into a solitary path of independent thought. That's perhaps a little bit easier, but perhaps many of us haven't done that yet. And when we look honestly at our lives, and I really mean honestly, getting really down to it, not pretending to ourselves even, can we really say that we've done it? Can we really say that we intend to do it? Or we have absolutely no intention of trying? I mean, we have to be honest about it. Do we try to do it? Are we afraid to face it? Are we not strong enough? Do we pay any attention to it at all? About trying to get away from the past and entering on a solitary pathway. I think you see that the real theosophical life is a tremendous challenge. We can't just trot along, you know, happily thinking everything's going to be all right. We've got to be doing something to ourselves, and in that we are doing something to our society. How do we think and behave towards other groups which are honestly and sincerely seeking for truth, even where we don't approve of their methods? Do we know enough about them to judge them? Do we feel, and horror of horrors even show, superiority? Is our reaction a brotherly one, in fact, or not, towards other groups? There's so many. We talk much about brotherhood, which is not a collection of similarities, but a world of infinite variety. Are we brothers in our behaviors to others? Do we still gossip and criticize? So on. What example do we in fact set to other people? I'm going through this quickly. Both the other brothers and HBB insist we have to change our lives. Now, does this inner ruler or the real self guide our lives or not? Do we listen or obey the still small voice? Are our values mostly those of time? Or do we sometimes try to take eternity seriously? We talk about it, but do we take it seriously? When we look back one day, too late, shall we say, what a lot of time I wasted on the unreal. I'm afraid I shall say that. Most of us will, probably. It will be so stupid, really, won't it, at that time? You'll think how stupid I was. You won't be able to do anything about it. Well, that's not intended to be a big stick. Please don't think it is. It's only to call our attention to the things that really matter. If we are theosophists, you can't expect them to matter to lots of other people, perhaps. But if we are thinking in terms that we mostly think of, in the eternity of things, in life following life, and growth that goes on from one to the other and so on, then we should think seriously about that sort of thing. Finally, you must be pleased to hear me say finally, with regard to the old and the young, the first question was, how should we older members best behave towards the young people who come into our branches? What should we avoid doing? This led to lively discussion, I can assure you, because all the young people came and said what they thought about us, and it was rather fun. However, we had a second question. Do the young ones often take the wrong impression of the older members? Do they judge superficially and too quickly? And the older members thought they did. Anyway, we had a very good session on that. And then finally, I think rather a serious question, how are we to increase contacts and effectiveness with children and younger teenagers? Because really that's a field in which we don't do anything very much at all. And there might be something we ought to think about. Well, I really think I've come to the end of my time, although by no means the end of all the possible things that there might be to say. But I know there are going to be other sessions regarding the future, and I hope that some of these and other ideas will come forward, and I hope we can have a good report on it so that it can be shared with other people in other parts of the world. Because this is the time now for planning. This is the time for thinking out new ways which we can immediately perhaps give effect to after the busy celebrations of next year are over. We can get down to some more hard work in a new way and in a new direction with new ideas and possibly even new people. And I say that without any disrespect to any of the older ones, but I do very much hope that we're going to have a lot of new people coming in, a lot of younger people who are going to help us to build a bridge from the past into the future. Thank you.